Emdad grew up in a town outside Dhaka. His father had a poorly paid government job with which he hoped to educate all his 8 children.
He always told us, no matter what, I'll work harder, but you should all go to school and college and university.
When he was just 9 years old, he knew his father would never be able to achieve his dream of educating all his children. So he made a promise to himself that he would finish his own education as soon as possible and get a job so he could help his father. This didn't go down well, as his father had hoped his eldest son would be a doctor or an engineer.
My father was absolutely unhappy and he was angry, but then when he saw that I was working in a very nice company and the salary was very good and I could send money enough and all my brothers and sisters had no difficulty whatsoever to pursue their higher studies. So he was a very happy man in the end.
With his sights set on making money, Emdad spotted an even better paid job with what would become Bangladesh's first garment factory. He got a job as a supervisor on the factory floor and was sewing shirts and mending machines. Within 5 years, he decided to start his own company with 4 friends. From the outset, Emdad never saw himself as a traditional boss.
We just wanted to create an environment of where we all can work exactly like a family, and who you call the boss actually is the head of the family. And when you are the head of the family, for example, I'm a father, but I'm not supposed to be really a boss. The father is a different thing. You care for the other members of the family and you care for their good time and bad time. You share their joy and sorrow both. So that exactly what we wanted to more or less have in our business concerns. Our workers are like our own kids.
And because there were only 126 workers, he knew them all by name.
It was a small factory and I used to roam around and go to each and every worker and ask them, how are you today? How is the family, etc., even when they were sick. In the evening, usually I took one or two supervisors with me and a bottle of Horlicks or something and went to the places where they lived. And it was difficult because they didn't have a decent accommodation. They would be in a shanty place, dirty, and then maybe very unhygienic. They would lie down on a few planks on bricks, not a proper bed at all. But these people didn't have a better life in their homes, in the villages. So it didn't make much of a difference for them in this sense.
Emdad spotted an even better paid job with what would become Bangladesh's first garment factory. He got a job as a supervisor on the factory floor and was sewing shirts and mending machines. Within 5 years, he decided to start his own company with 4 friends. From the outset, Emdad never saw himself as a traditional boss.
We just wanted to create an environment of where we all can work exactly like a family. And who you call the boss actually is the head of the family. And when you are the head of the family, for example, I'm a father, but I'm not supposed to be really a boss. The father is a different thing. You care for the other members of the family and you care for their good time and bad time. You share their joy and sorrow both. So that exactly what we wanted to more or less have in our business concerns. Our workers are like our own kids.
And because there were only 126 workers, he knew them all by name.
It was a small factory and I used to roam around and go to each and every worker and ask them, how are you today? How is the family, etc., even when they were sick. In the evening, usually I took one or two supervisors with me and a bottle of Horlicks or something and went to the places where they lived. And it was difficult because they didn't have a decent accommodation. They would be in a shanty place, dirty, and then maybe very unhygienic. They would lie down on a few planks on bricks, not a proper bed at all. But these people didn't have a better life in their homes, in the villages. So it didn't make much of a difference for them in this sense. But they thought like, now at least they have some job, and every month, at the end of the month, they have some sort of a minimum fixed earning. So they thought that was okay for them. And we couldn't do any better for them those days.
You couldn't afford to pay them more?
No, because we were not sure at all like whether we could continue this. We never thought like we are going to make it in the end. We always thought every month the apprehension was there, like, are we going to survive next month? Are we going to be able to put enough money together so that we can pay the wages and salary of the workers and employees? That was the main concern every month.
But Babylon just grew and grew. Now it employs 12,000 people and turns over 125 million a year, making clothes for high street chains like H&M, Zara and Tesco. And Emdad now sits in an air-conditioned office and can no longer claim he knows every worker by name. But as we go into the hot factory floor, where 500 workers are bent over sewing machines, he's keen to point out the few he does know.
Most of them, they know me. For example, this girl, she says like, in the past, I used to see you very frequently, but nowadays not so frequently as it used to be in the past.
Can I ask you, have you sat at a machine for 10 hours to make a garment? Do you know what it's like
to
do that?
I know, because I spent so many years of my early life in this profession, in the hot environment and noisy environment of the sewing floors, and I used to work so close with the workers.
Then Emdad spots a man who's been there nearly as long as he has.
This is the 19th year for him.
What does it mean for him to work at Babylon?
He says he feels like at Babylon treat them well.
He would say that, wouldn't he, then?
He said that. And I told him, you didn't try anywhere else within this 19 years' time. He said no.
Has he been promoted at all? I mean, what does he do now?
He came here first time. He used to do some sort of ironing. But eventually he was made sewing operator. And he's doing a very good process. Like, this is a pocket setting process, which is considered one of the most important processes.
But it's taken him 19 years to get from ironing to pocket making.
Yes. Let me ask him, like, what kind of educational background he has. This is a confession, kind of. I was surprised to hear what he said. He said to become a supervisor, you need certain qualities. He thinks he doesn't have that.
He doesn't think he's got those qualities.
Yeah.
Back in Emdad's office, he admits over the past 25 years, as the company's expanded and his time is taken up with other things, he no longer goes to their homes, but hopes that things have improved.
I don't say like all of them live in a very miserable condition. Some of them do. They should be looking forward to going home after the day's work.
But do you think that they can look forward to going home when they're going home to a concrete floor to sleep on with 9 other people?
That's a bad experience. I think that's just what do you call that, once off or something. So I don't think this is going to happen again.
But this isn't a one-off. 26-year-old Hafiz, who works in quality control, sleeps with 7 other garment workers in a single room. His co-worker Maria sleeps in a corridor. I ask Emdad whether he'd be up for one of those visits he used to make to his workers' homes. He agrees.
It's not easy for me to visit some of the girls' houses. So it's a rare privilege it would be, like, if I really could make it today.
First, we're off to Hafiz's new lodgings. He's married but can't afford to bring his wife to Dhaka, so he saves his money and sends it home to the village. He shares a single room with several others in the back streets of Ghazipur.
So, Emdad, how long is it since you came along some streets like this?
Honestly speaking, not very frequently I have this kind of opportunity. It's not that I don't want to come again, don't take me wrong. It's only because I don't have a strong reason.
When we arrive, Emdad is clearly shocked.
How many people live here, Hafiz?
7 people live here.
The room is tiny, with 2 double beds squashed together in which 7 people sleep. There's no room to stand. There are no mattresses, and the wood where your head is supposed to go is all broken. It's dirty, and there's a single light bulb and a tiny fan giving no relief from the 42-degree heat.
No, I'm not happy about this at all. This makes me very sorry about them, especially Hafiz. He works for Babylon, and being a Babylonian, I feel like it's not good. I feel kind of ashamed.
You prefer that he had somewhere better?
Absolutely. I don't know what we can do for him, but we can try for him. But then there could be many hundreds of other Hafizes. I wonder about that, like how much we can do about them. But this is, in a way, coming here, kind of an eye-opener for me. Sure. I heard about these things, but now I see in my own eyes. I think this is going to inspire me and us. Like, I'm going to talk to my other partners about that as well.
Outside, Hafiz is looking uncomfortable.
Did you feel embarrassed to be talking in front of your boss there?
I don't know what it is.
I'm a bit embarrassed with the condition, with my boss and standing here and seeing me in this condition. It is not good for me. I'm quite embarrassed.
But Emdad says the embarrassment is all his.
But I think I should be embarrassing him living in this condition. He's a very nice guy, no doubt about it. And I feel proud of having one of these gentlemen working for us. I believe he or his kind deserves more and a better life than this.
Next, we're off to Maria's home. She lives in a ground floor flat in a tower block just 5 minutes from Babylon. Because 9 other people live in the flat, Maria and her husband sleep in the corridor. Added to this, Maria's got problems in her marriage because her husband's family are asking her to pay a dowry 12 times her annual salary.
I can't believe it. Like, she lives in this condition and then still she has to pay money to the groom's family. That's a heinous sort of thing to hear. I don't know what your husband does. What does he do?
Baker.
She does nothing. He lives on you. I mean, like, she's working. She's earning money for the family, for her in-laws, perhaps. But she's not supposed to pay anything else beyond that.
Chesta korbo korar jonno.
So she says she will try for improvements and to afford a better life.
You said that Maria is one of your favorite workers. How does it make you feel to see where she lives?
I feel very bad, very sorry about her. Very, very sorry. And this is something I didn't know.
Do you think that probably in your workforce of 12,000 people, they all have a story?
Yes. We need many more visits of yours.
So when you go home tonight, do you think, how will you feel when you get home?
Actually, I have a lot to talk to my wife about. This is going to disturb me a lot, no doubt about it. I can't be sure that I would totally have a sleepless night or not, but at least there would be time or hours I would be really, really thinking about this. And I take another note for myself from this visit today, that from now on, I should be inquiring more about these kind of things. I'd be asking my managers, go and see in your own eyes and report back so that we can think about doing something, improving the living conditions of the workers that we have.
A few weeks after doing this interview, I was curious to know whether our visit to the workers' homes had prompted Emdad to take some action. So I gave him a call.
Hello, is that Emdad?
Hi there, yes, it's Emdad.
Thank you so much for making the time to talk to me. I just wanted to find out, since I've been in Bangladesh, what you had implemented or what you've done for the workers.
Well, since our visit, as we saw, Hafiz, he was living in a condition where he didn't even have a ceiling fan. The immediate thing that we could do is provide a ceiling fan, which can turn on over his head.
So just to recap, you've given Hafiz a ceiling fan. What about all the other workers? Have you come up with any kind of solution, an overall solution for them?
Well, it's not a solution as yet, but since then what we have done is all the managers in our companies have been instructed to launch a kind of fact-finding mission about this. They would be checking on the workers. So whenever we have the first report coming in, we would then study like what kind of requirements are there and what are the things that are kind of critical for them. This could be like, you know, similar things like a ceiling fan or piece of furniture.
So practically what you're going to do is you're going to find out what they need, and then they will then be able to apply to you to get a fan or a bed or something that they need. Is that the idea?
Probably we'll listen to the recommendation from our officers. And then in some cases where we would feel like interviewing or having a direct talk with the possible receiver of the donation, we would do that.
You'll talk individually to people.
That's not something I can tell you very emphatically at this moment, because if there will be just a handful of them, it's easy. But then if they are coming in tens of hundreds of in numbers, then it would be difficult.
Yes, because I can imagine that once it gets round that you're helping people out, maybe you're going to have swarms of people coming to ask you for things.
Absolutely, that's very possible. Yeah, so we have to be sure that we are just helping only the deserving candidates for that.